WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This month's full bio read is Peter Bergen's thoroughly researched, detailed biography, The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden. Bergen, one of the country's top national security experts, is the author of 6 books on geopolitics. For The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden, he had access to previously classified documents, almost 500,000 of them, and interviewed hundreds of people, including members of bin Laden's inner circle. Today, we pick up where the United States and the world have come to realize bin Laden's threats were real, not aspirational. In the summer of 1998, 2 U.S. embassies were bombed, one in Kenya, the other in Tanzania. The dual terrorist attacks killed 224 people, including 12 Americans, and wounded more than 4,000. On August 20th, President Clinton responded with force and cruise missiles to destroy al-Qaeda camps. How did the media and the public respond? With some skepticism, because 3 days earlier, Clinton was the first sitting president to testify before the Office of an Independent Counsel as the subject of a grand jury investigation. That said, leading up to September 11, 2001, the Clinton administration considered bin Laden and al-Qaeda a grave concern, while the Bush administration did not. Here's today's full bio conversation with Peter Bergen. After the bombings in Africa, President Clinton wanted to go after bin Laden in Afghanistan. And because he was in the middle of a sex scandal involving a White House intern, a lot of people thought it was a distraction. It was the wag the dog moment. Now, with 2020 hindsight, was Clinton correct, even though he may have been doing it for the wrong reason partially?
Well, he knew that he was going to take the wag the dog hit. The wag, as it happens, the press corps in Martha's Vineyard, where he was making these decisions, were watching Wag the Dog, which had recently come out when the announcement came out. So it was easy to kind of make this kind of connection. But I think Bill Clinton, he certainly wanted to respond to this, and he did. And unfortunately, part of the response was extremely ill considered. It blew up a Sudanese pharmaceutical plant that was supposedly linked to bin Laden, but it was really a genuine pharmaceutical plant. And then a number of these cruise missiles landed harmlessly on al-Qaeda training camps, killing a few people, but not bin Laden was far away. And the cruise missile attacks had the unintentional consequence of sort of turning bin Laden into kind of a global celebrity, because he seemed to be, escaping from the American superpower. But the Clinton administration certainly were pretty focused on bin Laden. There were a number of times when they could have killed him. They never took the shot because either the intelligence wasn't clear enough or concerns about collateral damage. And there's a long debate about, was there a time that he could have been killed? There was an effort by the White House and Michael Sheehan, who was the ambassador for counterterrorism at the State Department, and Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar at the White House, to really push for an armed drone program. And that kind of was being developed in the summer of 2001 and was really kind of an effort to try and kill bin Laden with an armed drone. The program was still kind of in its infancy when 9/11 happened, and the armed drones were only kind of deployed after 9/11, and it ultimately would have a substantial impact on killing people in Al-Qaeda, but not bin Laden.
I did want to clarify something or ask you to explain something. So for the CIA to get a clearing to capture or kill someone, bin Laden, they would need authorization. I believe it's through Executive Order 12333. Is that right?
Yeah. So after the Church Committee in the 1970s, there was an executive order against assassination. And so there was a memorandum of notification that Bill Clinton produced that was interpreted one way at the White House and another way at the CIA. It's never been publicly revealed, but the CIA interpreted it that bin Laden could only be killed in the context of a real capture operation, which kind of tied their hands a bit. The White House felt that they'd given authorization to kill bin Laden. The CIA interpreted didn't understand that, I think they really genuinely didn't. They believe that they hadn't really been given the authorization. I quote somebody in the book, Kofa Black, who ran the CIA Counterterrorist Center before 9/11, and he said, look, if Clinton really wanted us to kill bin Laden, that he would have issued an order that said, kill bin Laden, signed Bill Clinton. and instead, there was a kind of a memo that was, I don't know, a page or two long, which was caveated and lawyered up and wasn't that clear. And so the CIA kind of kept trying to mount these capture operations that if bin Laden wasn't captured, that it was okay to kill him in the context of a genuine capture operation as opposed to just trying to assassinate him. And of course, after 9/11, George W. Bush put out another memorandum of notification, I think on September 17th, 2001, which was much clearer and basically allowed lethal action against bin Laden and other leaders of Al-Qaeda. And obviously the rules changed after 9/11.
My guest is Peter Bergen. We're discussing his book, The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden. It's our choice for this month's full bio. Bin Laden had been planning the September 11th attacks for years, and the first suggestion of planes flying into the buildings came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in 1999. It was a different scenario. Bin Laden was not quiet about this. He often mentioned large-scale attacks on the U.S. Where was U.S. intelligence on the specific threat, on an attack on U.S. soil?
Well, CIA never got anybody inside Al-Qaeda, even on the peripheries. And, John Walker Lynn, the American Taliban, heard bin Laden talk about these attacks. A British recruit to Al-Qaeda heard scuttlebutt about these attacks. So it wasn't impossible to get people in, but the United States didn't have a diplomatic presence. It was hard to recruit people in Afghanistan. And so there was no penetration of Al-Qaeda that could have produced more accurate information. But there was plenty the strong sense of the CIA that something was up. And you didn't need access to classified information to have the same. During the summer of 2001, I sort of based on publicly available information, I was concerned that bin Laden was planning some kind of major anti-American attack because he had a pattern of signaling what his intentions, often publicly, before he blew up the USS Cole in Yemen, killing 70 American sailors, for the first time ever, he wore a Yemeni dagger. Every Yemeni male wears a dagger that is peculiar to Yemen. He wore it in a video, and he'd never worn it before, and that was his way of signaling, like, I'm going to be involved in this attack in Yemen. And he, in the summer of 2001, he released a 2.5-hour videotape that was circulating privately in jihadi chat rooms. And that tape I found quite concerning, and I wrote a letter to John Burns of the New York Times, who was the leading foreign correspondent of the Times at the time, sort of a 4-page letter laying out my concerns about what was happening. And John actually wrote a piece which didn't run in the newspaper because of an editing dispute. It ran on the website on September 9th, 2001. It was titled on videotape, Bin Laden Charts a Violent Future. 9/11 happened. They took it off the website. They later said that was a mistake. And the piece by John Burns only appeared in the New York Times on page 26 on September 12, 2001. But so the only reason I mentioned that anecdote, it was like you didn't need access to classified information to realize that there was something going on here. But the CIA actually did a very good job of providing strategic warning to the Bush administration about 9/11. I mean, the number of kind of classified documents in spring and 2000 and summer of 2001, warning of the potential attack. The threat stream was very, very high. And the oldest dodge in Washington is to blame a policy failure on an intelligence failure. So the Bush administration tends to say, hey, they didn't warn us. That's complete nonsense. This was a policy failure. The Bush administration was asleep at the switch from the Al-Qaeda threat. And there was a serious intelligence error, which was the CIA didn't communicate to the FBI about two of the hijackers who were living in San Diego, who crashed into the Pentagon, who were living there under their true names. It was information that was known to 50 or 60 people at the CIA. It was not communicated to the FBI until August the 25th of 2001. So certainly there was a kind of intelligence failure in a tactical sense, but in a kind of larger operational strategic sense, the CIA did a very good job of warning people like Gina Bennett, who had warned about bin Laden's threat as early as 1993, and a whole bunch of other people were constantly saying in the summer of 2001, we think something's going to happen.
Yet, as you cite in the book, there were members of the Bush administration who did not want to hear about Al-Qaeda. There's a little quote from AG John Ashcroft saying to an FBI agent after a budgeting memo that listed anti-terrorism as a high priority, quote, I don't want you to tell me about Al-Qaeda.
Which is kind of astonishing. And of course, Ashcroft then, was like a real war on terror kind of figure after 9/11. But that was the mindset at the time. They had 33 cabinet meetings before 9/11, only one of which was about Al-Qaeda. Their first cabinet meeting was about Iraq and the supposedly pressing problem of Saddam Hussein. So that was kind of the mindset, and it just, we all know that that was wrong. They came into office without the experience of Al-Qaeda blowing up American embassies on their watch and blowing up an American warship. Sandy Berger, who was Bill Clinton's national security advisor, was having daily meetings of the National Security Council around the time of the new millennium because there were a lot of concerns that Al-Qaeda would attack then. And there were very legitimate concerns because an Al-Qaeda recruit actually was arrested at the Canadian-U.S. border with a car full of explosives planning to go to LAX airport and blow it up in the middle of Christmas season. Luckily, he was a customs agent named Diana Dean. Noticed he was sweating and thought he was a drug dealer, and then looked at his car, and it turned out to be full of explosives. So these concerns were very legitimate. That all by way of saying the Clinton administration was pretty seized by this issue. The Bush administration came in; they were seized by Iraq, and they were kind of all veterans of the Cold War. They just didn't see non-state actors as being, kind of a real threat. Condoleezza Rice was a Soviet expert. Cheney had been Ford's chief of staff. Donald Rumsfeld had been Ford's secretary of defense. They were really steeped in kind of Cold War thinking.
You note that bin Laden was surprised at the devastation of the attacks, and that he also thought these attacks would cause the United States to leave the region, the Middle East. How was this a miscalculation on his part?
It was a spectacular miscalculation. It turns out that Pearl Harbor was a spectacular miscalculation for Imperial Japan. It was a great tactical victory for them, which led to their demise. And so bin Laden really believed his own propaganda, which is a kind of classic issue that many people suffer from, which is that, he really believed that the United States was a paper tiger. He surrounded himself by people. He would kind of shop for people who agreed with his assessment within Al-Qaeda. And, basically he was encouraged in this view by some others in Al-Qaeda that the United States wouldn't really respond. And it was a crazy idea because, obviously the United States had pulled out of Somalia after the Black Hawk Down incident. Reagan had pulled U.S. troops out of Lebanon after 241 American service personnel were killed in the Marine barracks attack in 1983. And bin Laden thought of these as a model, but the United States was not going to pull out of the Middle East because it was attacked on Tuesday morning and almost 3,000 of its civilians were killed at the Trade Center or at the Pentagon on Flight 93 that was crashed in Pennsylvania. That was not going to happen. And in fact, the United States It's interesting. The Japanese had some of the same kind of assessment of the United States that when they carried out the Pearl Harbor attack, that it was kind of weak and wouldn't respond. And Bin Laden had no plans for what then transpired. He didn't have a plan for really the United States kind of coming into Afghanistan, allying with Afghan militias, using massive air power to destroy the Taliban regime in 3 months. He didn't see it coming.
That was my conversation with Peter Bergen, author of The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden, our September full bio read. Tomorrow we'll wrap up with details about Operation Neptune Spear, the secret Navy SEAL strike that killed bin Laden. And we'll hear from Bergen about visiting that location, bin Laden's safe house, before it was destroyed. That's tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.